Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And boy, what a complicated day it is today, April 1. Yeah. It's April Fool's Day. It's Easter. For those of you who...
It seems much too early for Easter.
It is early for Easter. We've already said happy Passover for those doing that.
I guess we'll say happy Easter, right?
I did say happy Easter.
Oh, you did?
I did.
In your Easter bonnet with all the flowers upon it.
I guess
you'll be
so.
The smartest lady in the Easter parade.
And we keep waiting for spring to break through. My crocuses are going back to where they came from, unfortunately.
Yeah, they came out early, the silly buggers.
Yeah. Now, to lead off the today's program, this woman is a very important figure in culinary traditions. She wasn't known for a while, and now all of a sudden she's coming into her own. This is Edna Lewis, who was famous for her Southern cooking.
She's sort of like a real icon.
She is an icon, and I think after you listen to Sarah Franklin, the editor of this book of essays about Edna Lewis, you're going to see that she is such a deeply thoughtful person. I was very impressed with this interview, and I hope that we can keep in touch with Sarah Franklin as well, and to see what she's doing, because it seems she catches the importance of what she's working on, and she's very serious about it. Anyhow, let's listen to Sarah talk about the book of essays on a real icon, Edna Lewis, in the culinary field of today. Sarah Franklin has edited a really marvelous book, a collection of essays about a really mysterious and fabulous character called Edna Lewis, who is, she's going to tell us, Sarah's going to tell us about all the accomplishments of Edna Lewis, because my mind's always boggled when I think of all the stuff that she did even before she made her mark in the culinary field. Sarah, you started telling me earlier on, and I wanted you to start at that point, about your connection with Judith Jones, who's also another absolutely amazing woman in the field, and how you got involved with this book about Edna Lewis.
Sure. So right after Judith Jones retired from her post as senior editor at Knopf, she was 88 years old.
Yeah.
I was asked to, remarkable.
Yeah, she is.
I was asked to collect her life oral history, which is a fancy way of saying I was given the privilege of sitting down and interviewing her over a course of 6 months and getting her to reflect on her life and work. And in preparing for that project, I did an enormous amount of research. And one of the things that I did, of course, was reread Judith Jones's memoir, The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. And as I was rereading that book, which I had read several times before, I was really struck by this moment where Judith Jones, in her cookbook editing career, turned away from collecting cuisines, international cuisines, cuisines of the world, and started looking at American regional food. And Edna Lewis was the first cookbook author that she published in that vein. And that struck me as tremendously significant. The book that they first did together was called The Taste of Country Cooking, and it came out in 1976, which was the bicentennial of the country. And it was really striking to me that the book was about Southern cooking. It was about a very particular part of the South. It was Orange County, Virginia, which is where Edna Lewis was born and grew up, a rural part of the state, neither coastal nor mountainous, or that rolling, green, verdant, incredibly fertile part of the state. And that this was a woman and a black woman, no less, who'd been raised in a community that was settled by formerly enslaved people. And so it was this remarkable entree into the world of American cooking that Judith Jones began with, and that she chose to do it with this remarkable character, Edna Lewis, who had this incredible control of language and also this really, really lyrical way in the kitchen.
And elegance. Everybody talks about how elegant she was. I mean, where did this all come from? She was on a farm in the South, and where did all this
It's interesting that you ask that, because a lot of the people who are scholars of sort of that mid-South that area in Virginia, like to point out and remind us wisely of the Jeffersonian tradition there, which is deeply influenced by France. And so what you had was this specifically right. American culture that was undeniably influenced by the sort of elegance and refinement of French culture in terms of clothing, in terms of cuisine, and in terms of crops that have been brought back. So there was wine drinking, and there was souffle making, and there was incredibly sophisticated cooking. And Edna Lewis's family members had been influenced by those kitchens. And so while at once she grew up in this very provincial small town, small community, she grew up in a community that had incredible global influence in a way. And so in some ways I think she's sort of a remarkable archetype of Americanness. She's from this very small dot on the map, and yet there was sort of a finger into the global world, and she always grew up with that in the kitchen.
Well, I mean, she did so many things. She had such an innate talent for so many things. There's something in her character which I must say I still, even reading all these essays, cannot put my finger on, but there's something in her character that distinguished her or made her unique among all these people of her period, of her career, the things she did. I mean, there's something outstanding innately about her that I can't put my finger on.
I think that's right, and I think it's one of the reasons that people, myself included, are so intrigued by her. You know, she wasn't well known personally by a lot of people in the media. She sort of eluded that world of hype. And there was a wonderful profile written by the novelist Chang Rai Lee in Gourmet magazine not long before she died that spoke to that she was at once really famous, and yet she shied away from the limelight in a way. And you got the sense that she didn't necessarily want all the fame and attention that was being showered upon her. Not that it wasn't deserved, but that she didn't necessarily want it. And so I think there's something really interesting about her as this woman who fits into lots of different boxes and yet doesn't neatly fit into any of them.
Right, and the people writing these essays, actually, I mean, there seems to be a sense that goes through there that they do not know her very well either.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think each of the contributors to this book was touched by a certain piece or certain pieces of her, either in person or in her writing or both, or those who were lucky enough to eat her food that she actually prepared herself. And yet there was always a sense that you couldn't quite grasp her as a whole. She was always on the move. She was moving regionally. Her books changed in style over the years. She was very difficult to pin down, and I think that's part of what makes her so interesting.
I was intrigued by what you chose as the format, if you like, for the book. I mean, why not just write a book called The Life Story of Edna Lewis or something like that? I mean, why do a series of essays that essentially were all written by somebody else?
Yeah, it's a good question.
I mean, it must have been a reason for that. I'm intrigued by what it is.
Yeah, there are two reasons. One is, you know, I was first asked if I was thinking about doing a biography of Edna Lewis. That was the genesis of this book, was that question. And I immediately had the reaction that I was unqualified and I was the wrong person to do it. I mean, look, I'm a white woman from New York. And so for me to claim the story of a black Southern woman seemed deeply inappropriate. So that was sort of a gut reaction. I also don't love being an authority on a subject. I really like being in the position to gather people around me and discuss something. I love the element of a salon or a conversation. So I really wanted the book to take the form of conversation. I wanted to be in a position to elicit responses to the life and ongoing impact of this woman. And I also wanted it to start a conversation rather than sort of say, here's the whole story, it's over, and this is the final word. I was hoping it would start something. And what's really interesting is that in the almost 3 years since I started work on this book, that conversation has already begun, and the book is, in fact, entering into an ongoing conversation, which is really exciting. I think Edna Lewis has come to represent both real excitement in American food culture and what's happening now with attention to regionality, to women in the kitchen, to people of color in the kitchen, but also is calling attention to a lot of painful aspects of how we've ignored the people who've actually created American cuisines.
Exactly.
And so I feel like this book is coming into a slipstream of very, very relevant conversations around American food and culture at large.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely correct. And the timing couldn't be more on target, I would say. How did you select these essayists?
So I wanted to make sure that Edna Lewis's talents were represented by those who were talking about her. So I saw her as really, really talented as both a writer and a cook, and I wanted to make sure that neither of those got more attention than the other. And the other thing is she was both a professional cook and a home cook. She wrote for home cooks, she taught home cooks, and she grew up as a home cook. She was not someone who went to culinary school and came up in the sort of restaurant brigade world. And so I wanted to make sure that she was portrayed as a professional, but also someone who was deeply rooted in home cooking. And so I went looking for people who I thought either might have something to say about Ms. Lewis because they were paying particular attention to Southern regional cooking now or to the writing of the American South and the kitchens of the American South, or people who had said something about her somewhere else, either in a piece of writing or an interview somewhere. And it was a lot of cold calling, truth be told. I just sort of started looking people up and saying, you know, I have a feeling you might have something to say about Ms. Lewis. And what was remarkable to me was the excitement that each of these contributors had. Nobody said no. No one said, you know what, I actually don't think I have anything else to say about her.
Oh, really?
Interesting. Everyone said, you're right, I have a lot to say about her. I, in fact, have a story to tell about how she's affected my writing or my cooking or both, and I'd like to tell it. And so this book could have been, you know, quadruple its size easily in terms of contributions if I had endless time to collect. And so one of my hopes for the sort of life of this book is that people keep telling stories about Ms. Lewis and her continued impact on American cooking and history now.
I'm wondering if some of them didn't have a feeling of guilt, which they were able to assuage because they got to write just a little bit of a book, when the book they probably feel like they should have written was the whole book that you wrote together
well,
with their help.
I didn't write a whole book. I can't at all pretend to take credit for that. I mean, one of the joys of working on this book was that it was really a 2-year conversation with these contributors. I was not in the position of having to do the exhaustive work of a biographer, which is to attempt to get to every detail and then make sense of it. I had 22 fabulous contributors who were helping me do that. But, you know, I want to be really clear, and for those who read the book, they'll see this. The book does not take the shape of a biography. In fact, you know, there, we attempted to make sure there was enough of the sort of factual detail of Edna Lewis's life that anyone who picked it up who didn't know who she was could get a basic understanding of the details of her life and the facts of her life and where she lived and where she worked and the spaces that she moved through. But it's really about how her life touched other people's lives, which is part of the reason I was not drawn to the form of a conventional biography, because I think sometimes biography doesn't deal with that question. It tries to tell the story of a life in a vacuum, but what it doesn't deal with is the sort of ripple effect of that life onto other lives. And that was what I was really interested in, because I was seeing through the U.S. postal stamp that honored Edna Lewis, through Frances Lamb's cover story on the New York Times Magazine that came out in 2015.
Yeah, that was amazing.
This was a woman whose legacy not only is continuing, but in fact is rising posthumously and rising in a very, very big way into the world of American food culture right now. And so I wanted readers to sense that this is someone who has an impact on lives. She doesn't live stuck in amber. She doesn't live stuck in history. She is continuing to impact people now.
For those people who, like me, I guess in a sense, who until this book arrived had never even heard of Edna Lewis.
You did too. We interviewed Scott.
Well, I can't find when we did. I
mean, well, we did.
I'm sure we probably did, but I sure can't find it. I'm referring to something I saw in one of the essays. If you ask most Americans of our generation, and yours for that matter, who's the most important female voice in American cuisine, most people would quickly say the lady from Chez Panisse.
Alice Waters.
Yeah. And what I want listeners to understand, and we haven't said it out loud yet, is that Edna Lewis is probably several times more important than Alice Waters.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes to the development of American cuisine, and she's probably significantly, and Judith herself would say so, she's probably...
Sarah.
I'm not talking about Judith.
I'm loath to say that someone is more important than someone else, because I think it depends who you're asking, yeah. Right? So in the world of contemporary female restaurateurs, Alice Waters may in fact be more important. There's an argument to be made there. But when you're looking at American history or Southern American history or Black American history, yes, I think there's no argument that Edna Lewis is far more important. And one of the things that I think is so remarkable about what Edna Lewis did, particularly with her book, The Taste of Country Cooking, is she was not claiming to start any kind of revolution. She was saying, hey, wait a second, pay attention here. We've already been doing this. We've already been living off the land. We've already been cooking with terrific abundance, with incredible refinement. And we've been doing it outside, completely divorced from the white world, in fact.
Yes.
And so it's this rewriting of African-American history as its own entity and as a culture worth paying attention to. She doesn't claim revolution, she claims history. So I think a big difference there is Alice Waters was really saying, you know, I've been to France, I've spent time in Europe, I'm looking forward to the future of American food. And what Edna Lewis was doing is saying, we've already got something really special here. And if we don't protect it, if we don't record it, if we don't keep practicing it, we are going to lose it. So they're really sort of looking, you know, it's the two faces looking in opposite directions, past and present. And so I think they represent two very different things.
Yeah, it's...
I was just trying to give people a sense of the emphasis that should be placed on this lady and why it is that people might really... gain an enormous amount of satisfaction out of reading your book.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I think that reading these essays, you have to come away with the idea that this woman was very important for the whole development, and for a long period of time, even before she was famous, of American cuisine. I mean, once anybody encountered that cookbook, it was like, bang, whiz bang, right?
Right, right.
It was an eye-opener. It totally changed everybody's perceptions.
That's right. And I think what's also so interesting is The Taste of Country Cooking was not her first cookbook. It is her most famous. But before that, she wrote the Edna Lewis cookbook. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Tony Tipton Martin, who's one of the contributors to my book, points out really, really crucially, is that the Edna Lewis cookbook claimed the food that she cooked professionally in restaurants and as a caterer as her own. And that is something that for a long time, and really until very recently, that was the domain of male chefs. Male chefs got to talk about what they cooked in restaurants and sort of claim that professional status of chef. But Edna Lewis was doing it first, and she was doing it as someone who became a chef partner in a restaurant in New York City for some of the most famous people in arts and culture in 1949. I mean, it's remarkable. It simply wasn't on the map at the time. And 20 years later, she sort of pops up and with this cookbook and takes it and claims it as her own publicly. I mean, it's this incredibly political, very subversive, very empowered stance.
Yeah, no, I mean, that whole... the period when she was holding forth in the New York City literati, what do you call it, the scene. Did people recognize not just her as a wonderful figure, but how important she was to the culinary scene?
You know, I think that's a really important question, but I'm going to lean on Judith Jones a little bit here, who loved to remind me in the time that I spent with her, there was no food scene. It didn't exist. And so people did admire her cooking. She won critical acclaim in restaurant reviews, and it was beloved, absolutely. And people would regularly ask if she had trained in France because her cooking seemed so refined and it had certain techniques that were clearly drawn from French classical cuisine, like making soufflés. But she wasn't at the center of any foodie culture because there was no such thing at the time. There were restaurants, there were good restaurants, there were cooks, there were good cooks.
Yeah.
But there was none of this sort of food world as it came to be really beginning with Julia Child And yeah, so you have the rise.
Sarah, put dates to that. Put dates to that. I mean, we began seeing a scene in the 70s.
Mastering the Art of French. It was earlier than that. So Mastering the 60s, Art of French Cooking came out in 61, and then she went on television in 1963. And a lot of people argue, and I think I agree with them, that when she went on national TV in 1963 and really became household figure, that sort of demonstrating French cooking as something that everyone could do, but also as a way of refining oneself, right? It was a way of becoming cosmopolitan and sophisticated. But that was really when food started to move towards the center of American culture. That was the moment in 1963.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I actually learned to cook through her book, and I always tell the story of how I decided to make her charcuterie garnie, and I bought the stuff and set out to cook dinner, and I got everything together, and it says, now simmer for 6 hours.
I think many people learned to cook from that book. Absolutely. I mean, it was tremendously important.
Yeah.
But there's also something very important to learn from that, a lesson to be learned from that.
Read the
bloody
recipe, right,
from the beginning to the end.
That's right.
Now, tell me what, you know, I'm asking you almost impossible questions, and I know that, Sarah, but I think that the people who get this book are going to be able to answer a lot of things on their own from this book. But the questions I'm asking you, I mean, where do you think this is all going? You said you hope this would be the beginning of a discussion and evolution. I mean, give us more particulars about how you think this whole thing with Edna Lewis and her history, and where is it all going to go?
Well, I think this book is coming out at a moment where issues of gender and race are at the forefront of conversations about everything in American culture.
Exactly.
But they have been really swirling in food culture in the last couple of years in a way that really preceded how they've exploded back onto the scene of sort of culture at large. I think there have been very pointed conversations, very pointed case studies in restaurant culture and food culture around misrepresentations, around the two, what I call the two loaded A words, authenticity and appropriation, right?
Yeah.
And so what I think Edna Lewis and remembrances of her and close looks at her invite us to do is look at those really uncomfortable issues of authenticity and appropriation and start to pick them apart with a real person who had a real life that was really complicated and really special. And, you know, one of the things I think is really wonderful about looking at Edna Lewis and her life and work is that it doesn't fit into tidy boxes.
It
doesn't at all, right? And so I think part of where I've gotten in the years that I've been paying close attention to her is that her life helps us ask more questions than it helps answer. And I think that's a moment where we're at in American culture right now, is people beginning to say, you know what, we've been a country with incredible hubris for so long now, and there's this sort of moment of humility that's emerging to some, not to all, but to some, saying maybe we haven't been doing it quite right, or maybe we haven't been paying attention to one another carefully enough and actually listening to what one another have to say. And Edna Lewis was wonderful that way because she was so clear about who she was and what she stood for, but she said it in a soft way. She couldn't make you listen, but she was there with her message if you paid attention. And so I think there's something very powerful about going back to these books that are 40 plus years old at this point and saying, oh my gosh, she was right there all along saying part of what we need to hear now, which is this is a country of regions. This is a country of diversity. We are not all the same.
Yeah,
we will never be
right
all
now
the same.
It's important because,
right.
And she was never strident from everything I've ever read about anything.
No. No, she, and
she
a lot
could
of
have been. She could have been very arrogant.
Quite quiet. She could. She could. She had the talent to merit that behavior, but that was not the way she was.
Yeah.
She proceeded along and she did everything with quality and finesse and care. And if you wanted to pay attention, she was there for you. And if you didn't, well, you're lost. And so I think it's sort of remarkable that she's reemerging posthumously and sort of offering up those lessons again.
Well, we thank you. We thank your 22, I think you said, contributors.
Yeah.
And I think this is going to open a lot of eyes.
Yeah, and Sarah, you have such good thoughts on this. I'm so happy that we got to interview you. And, you know, I wish the interview could be attached to the book because it says a lot even beyond what you wrote.
Yes. Well, I'm hoping it reaches a large audience. I think there's a lot in there for lots of different kinds of people.
Yeah. Well, after this, I don't know what you're going to tackle next, however.
I'll tell you when I get there.
All right. It's a deal. Sarah B. Franklin, and the book is Edna Lewis, At the Table with an American Original, and she certainly was. And so are you, Sarah Franklin. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Edna Lewis seems like the kind of person you wish you could meet them and have dinner with them and enjoy the food they're cooking and just generally say, what a great lady you are, and I'm so proud of you being an American and being a Southerner and being an African American, all that great stuff. And at the same time, I understand she was a very quiet person who really.
Yeah, we talk about that, dear.
Yeah, yeah. So she was just there, and we're glad she was there, and we hope there'll be many more people who will now enjoy knowing everything that she's contributed to the cooking of the United States and especially the South. And as I should have said, don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, for those of you that maybe think we're on a heavier side of things with our last interview, we turn to Tata. What is the most seasonal item in today's, Easter, on the Easter basket, the Easter bunny? Hello, the Easter bunny brings jelly beans. Never did understand that.
Is that right?
Brings eggs. I don't understand.
Yeah, I didn't. But apparently, this is the season anyway.
This is the season
for jelly beans.
And just as an aside, Peter and I were once in Italy for Easter, and we were trying to explain Peter Rabbit to the Italians in Italian. And of course, you might know they don't have Peter Rabbit. Who do they have? Michael or something? Rabbit.
I think you're getting it mixed up with France. And in France, they certainly have Johnny Rabbit.
They
don't have Peter Rabbit. And the Italians don't have anything to do with rabbits, I don't think.
But anyhow.
I thought you were talking about that time we were in Italy for Easter, and the Nonino family were right next to us. The little girl, the youngest child in the family, was probably only like 1 or 2 years old. Didn't like it at all that they tied the ribbon from her Easter egg
around her head. But she looked cute.
She looked cute, and we took a picture, yeah. And that's how we got to know the Nonino family in the first place.
But so we're back to jelly beans, and of course, I'm sure they're all just dying to know what is the most popular flavor jelly bean. Believe it or not, the outgoing favorite is licorice, black licorice.
Don't give the secret away. Make them listen to the interview.
Okay. Well, if you want to know what the most popular flavor for jelly beans is, listen up.
Yeah, Tom from the candy store has the answer.
Tom Carter. This is just a timely little bit of news. Because we're coming up on Easter, which is what, April 1, I think?
Now, what's the timely news?
We're going to be talking to Tom Carter, who's going to tell us the timely news, and he's media director for a company called The Candy Store, which sells you know what, and lots of it. But anyhow, I don't know how it started, but I got this email, Tom, that said that actually the traditional favorite jelly bean flavor, and we all know this is jelly bean season, Easter, was licorice, but it's been kicked to the curb by a new flavor. What is the most popular flavor in jelly beans right now?
That's right. Black licorice is no longer the king of jelly beans. A new king has come, and its name is buttered popcorn.
And does it taste just like that?
It does. It tastes, you know, buttery and creamy, and has that little salty flavor for popcorn, and it's pretty good.
Now, you're sure there's not something here about political correctness?
No, not at all, not at all. Hey, one of the biggest things about this that would surprise us was how divisive these flavors are. Black licorice as well, which is number two. It didn't get kicked all the way down the list. But buttered popcorn and black licorice, the numbers bore for us that they were the most popular. And, you know, when you take surveys and you go through the sales data like we did, you see the positive side. You see people like this flavor. You know, we don't have negative sales data. People don't not buy if they're, you know, it's not their favorite color or flavor. So when we put this information out there, we were really surprised at the backlash. People were saying, oh, buttered popcorn, oh, black licorice. So many people contacted us and said, you're crazy. This is fake news or whatever. They couldn't believe it. But it is. It must be just a really divisive thing.
Well, you know, we got a flavor of ice cream for Thanksgiving called turkey and gravy. And it was. Wow. It tasted exactly like turkey and gravy.
Which meant it wasn't very good.
It wasn't.
I like it. I'm eating it still.
Now, the information that we got sent to us ahead of time referred to regional variations as well. Now, can you tell us more about that aspect of it?
Yeah, it does seem like there are some states, you know, state to state, the favorites are different. It's hard when you're looking at it to really draw any sort of conclusions as far as, like, greater regional favorites. I mean, buttered popcorn was the favorite in New York and California and Texas. Watermelon was a favorite in Oregon and Florida and Wisconsin. So it's kind of all over the place, the favorite. It wasn't like on the East Coast it's popcorn and on the West Coast it's licorice or something easy to sort of define like that.
Uh-huh. And you couldn't distinguish anything between blue states and red states as the lexicon these days is? I've always worried about that because in England, left wing is red.
Yes.
Now, why the GOP is red, I have no idea, because they're certainly not very liberal.
Interesting. But isn't it true that I could be totally wrong in this because I'm not a politician, but isn't it true that what's now the Republicans used to be the left-wing party in America, like in the 1800s or something? So
it
maybe that
was more liberal. It was, it was the abolitionist party, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Lincoln was a Republican, for example.
Okay. Right? Yeah. So maybe they used to line up and they diverged over the years and the colors. I don't know.
What gave you the idea for this survey, which is really off the wall, isn't it?
I just think this is such fun. It's fun stuff to talk about and to learn about. I mean, going through the data was just kind of interesting for me, and for us in general. We, you know, we're in a candy business, and useful for us to have this information. But it's also just really interesting about the different flavors that people like and how that changes across state lines. And it's easy for us to pull data like that because, you know, it's all in our databases. And we did some surveys, too, to see, you know, if what people say that they like matches up with what they'll actually spend their money on. And for the most part, it really did.
I think without realizing it, or probably this is exactly what you did think, introducing a flavor like buttered popcorn, it would seem to me would extend the attraction of jelly beans to people who would never ordinarily think of buying a jelly bean.
You mean a new and unique flavor?
A new and unique flavor of candy. And
right.
Maybe not even candy lovers would buy some anyway. They would buy it because they wanted to try it, or they'd buy it to give to their special friends. Or maybe to the people who are not their friends.
Yeah, depending on how they feel. That's interesting. You know, another thing about this survey is that these flavors have been favorites for a long time, actually. And it's surprising that some people are just coming to them as if they're new flavors. But black licorice, you mentioned Ronald Reagan before, and it was his favorite jelly bean flavor. And it's been one of the favorites since, you know, before Ronald Reagan. And buttered popcorn kind of came on the scene in the 90s.
But really? I never had it. Nobody's offered me any buttered popcorn-flavored jelly beans ever.
Yeah, they're really popular. Jelly Belly sells them. And
oh, yeah, I know Jelly Belly. I mean, I know them very well. They always put on a show at the Fancy Food Show. They dress up and dance and do all kinds of funny things.
Oh, yeah. There was one year they had a whole figure of Barack Obama, right?
Yeah, they had made out of jelly beans.
Made out of jelly beans.
Yeah, and that's cool.
It looked pretty good, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool.
So, anyhow, so what's your next caper?
Well, that's right now we're kind of looking at what we're going to do next. The jelly beans has been a huge success. It's been, you know, we've gotten a lot of great feedback from it. So obviously this type of thing is something that interests people, and we're looking at what we do next. I'm not really sure. What do you guys think? Do you have any suggestions?
I don't know.
No, to tell you the truth, no, not really. We don't eat a lot of jelly beans. I've been known to eat chocolate every once in a while, but
there you go.
Jelly beans are not really big in England.
Oh, right.
The big thing traditionally in England was what they call hard candy.
Boiled sweets,
things that you suck and they diminish over time, but they satisfy you for quite a long time.
A dolly pack, or what is it called? Dolly pack.
Now, dolly mixtures are different. Dolly mixtures are little things made out of licorice sheets and sheets of...
Oh, okay, I know what that is.
You know what dolly mixtures are?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Well, now, you have all kinds of candy. What is your website so actually people can go and look and see the kinds of things that are popular now?
Sure. Our website is candystore.com. That's our name and our website all together, so it's kind of easy to remember. And they can go there and, you know, browse thousands of different types of candies that we have on the website.
Is there a store locator, too?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a store locator as well so people... know where they can go and get some, or do they just have to send you an order through the internet?
Yeah, it's a website, so it's all e-commerce. It's all ordered through the website. We don't have any physical locations, so there wouldn't be a location finder necessarily. But you just jump online and place an order.
But you don't sell into candy stores.
Well, we do sell into candy stores and a lot of smaller candy stores spread out across the country. We just sort of sell to them directly, and they, you know, go on and resell it on their own.
Okay.
So we don't actively promote them.
Have you been ever in one of the Dillon stores, the candy stores?
Yes, those are gorgeous.
Aren't they incredible?
Yeah, beautiful.
Oh, dear. Well, you have to like candy, I guess. It's a real fantasy land if you're a candy freak.
Yeah, and bright colors, yeah.
Oh, yeah, indeed. Well, I'm glad that you could tell us about this new flavor so we can look out for this. I'm sorry it's from the 90s, and it took me this long to focus in on it.
Yeah, well, give it a try.
Aside from that,
what's the hottest candy that I may not ever have tried yet that's coming on the market?
Oh, wow, gosh, there's so much right now. I mean, you know, with Easter coming up, jelly beans are very popular, but the other really popular candy for Easter and also quite sort of divisive is Peeps. Have you ever had Peeps?
Oh, God, yes. They still have Peeps? I haven't had a Peeps since I was a child.
They still have Peeps, and they have all kinds of new flavors of Peeps as well that are creative.
But aren't they made out of something that people found were nasty, some kind of an animal glue or something like that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't know anything about that, but I do know some people love it and some people absolutely are disgusted by it. So,
I think they're disgusting.
Yeah. But you're not alone. You're not alone.
Well, I think you should get in touch with Chuck Todd at Meet the Press and find out about this link between political persuasion and the colors and flavors of jelly beans. I'm sure there's something in there somewhere. And
Paul, do you have his number? Can you give me his
phone? I can't. I'm sure you'd be able to find the producers of his show if you had a great idea. In the meantime, thank you so much for taking the time to
Tom Carter, you've been a real trooper. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Great chatting with you guys.
Okay.
Have a great weekend and a happy Easter.
And you too. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, once again now, we have a lot of fun coming up. We have Alejandra del Peral, which actually means of the pear in Spanish, although we're talking to him about apple cider. How about that one?
Apple cider from New York State.
Called Nine Pin Cider, and he'll tell us why it's called that. And we'll talk about what all they do, how they do it, and their special the current project with an urban orchard.
And this is kind of a who knew that Eastern New York State was a hotbed of cider production.
Right. Well, we did know actually.
Well, we found that out anyway.
Right.
And it's an interesting story, and I'm sure that Alejandro and his collaborators are going to do more great things with cider.
Yeah. Now we have this really interesting guest, Alejandro del Peral, which means pear, although we're going to talk to him about apple cider, but they also make pear cider. And there's so many other things about his company, Nine Pin Cider. I don't even know where to start, Alejandro. First of all.
Why don't you begin at the beginning?
Yeah, let's begin at the beginning. A nine pin means what and why?
Well, we started the company in the fall of 2013. And we were, coming up with a name. We wanted something that was going to be place-based to our hometown here of rural upstate New York. We're actually, the cidery is actually located in downtown Albany, believe it or not. But the foundation of it is in the apple orchards of Columbia County. And so Nine Pin is a reference to a local legend up here called the Legend of Rip Van Winkle. And it's
there you go.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people are familiar with it. It's everyone learns about it when they're little, and it's a detail from that story. And I'll just give you a quick synopsis of what happens. But Rip Van Winkle is this character who hates working, spends his time, avoiding work up in the Catskill Mountains in the Hudson Valley. And one day he's in the Catskills and he stumbles across a group of Dutchmen playing a game of nine pin bowling, and they're all drinking from a keg. And obviously, in my version of the story, it's a keg of hard cider. And Rip Van Winkle ends up loving what he's drinking so much that he drinks too much of it, and he ends up falling asleep for 100 years. And
yes.
The American Revolution and all these things happen to him.
Isn't there a headless horseman in here somewhere too?
Yeah. It's all. Well, it's not in that story, but it's all Washington Irving. The short story is written by the author Washington Irving. Yeah,
same
take place in the Hudson Valley.
And,
so anyways, Nine Pin is a game that Rip played when he drank so much that he didn't fall asleep. Yeah.
Now, a number of us food writers around in this area have been talking for probably the last 8 years about this big cider revival. There are parts of the world, of course, that have never seen the popularity rescind, such as the Basque region and so forth in Spain and France. But nobody wanted to write the story because it just seemed so large. But there is certainly a revival of interest in cider in the U.S., is there not?
Yeah. No, the category has been growing tremendously. It's sort of in an interesting phase right now. But, yeah, I mean, we've seen a huge growth, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, of people's interest in hard apple cider or just cider.
Yeah. Now, why is it in an interesting place? You gonna talk about that?
Well, the big market trends that are being published right now show actually declining sales for hard cider, but that is only in the big major companies that are nationally distributed.
Yeah, because they bought up all these people like Angry Orchard we interviewed years ago. And they got bought up by somebody big.
Boston Brewing.
Right, so they're purchased. They're owned by Sam Adams.
Yeah, right.
But companies like Angry Orchard and other are showing declines in their cider sales, whereas regional small craft producers are actually the ones who are still, our companies are still showing significant amount of growth, and it's really a testament to the people who are interested in this, which are people who tend to think about, local food and local cider kind of fits right into that model.
Right. Now, what, you always have a new product. How many products do you make, and can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. We have, our core cider, just our signature hard apple cider is we sell the most of that. We work the hardest at making it. We make the most of that. But we do, we are like any good, craft producer with the ability to, operate at smaller volumes. We make as many different styles of cider as we can get our hands on. Basically, we have 26 small tanks that we use that are 200 gallons or less to do a batch every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks we release a new one, and it's usually just in our tasting room. But we also do sort of release batches on a wholesale level as well. But we really do focus a lot on our signature hard apple cider, and then we also have a ginger one where we add dried ginger to it and age it with dried ginger. That we make a lot of, but yeah, we're constantly experimenting. That's the fun of it.
And we got a press release about your the rosé wine thing. Peter's interested in that. You were talking to him about that.
Yeah, so the rosé cider is also kind of a hot thing. We actually made we did it for the first time last year. We had a local winery around here call us during the fall and say, he said to us that, listen, I just finished pressing my grapes, and I've got these leftover grape skins. Do you think you'd be interested in taking them and we collaborate and make a cider with them? And so we kind of did it by chance, or almost opportunistically. And last year we made the batch of and we call it the Cidre Rosé, and it was phenomenal, and it got all this media attention. In Style Magazine wrote an article called "The Drink of the Summer," but we only made 2,000 gallons of it, and we sold out and week and a half. So the In Style's 2017 Drink of the Summer was gone before the first week in April. So,
I bet you'll make it this year. Huh?
Right. So, anyways, this year we improved on our process from the previous year. We made some mistakes year one. Obviously, the first time you do anything, there's things you learn, and we were able to source a larger quantity of grapes from some vineyards in the western part of New York State, and this year's Cidre Rosé is amazing. We just released it last week and have been drinking it nonstop and really enjoying it. It's good cider.
Now, a lot of people don't know that in fact one of the biggest apple growing regions is in the western part of the state of New York, but you're further to the east, I think. But I'm
correct,
interested.
Yeah, actually, the biggest most apples are actually in Wayne County, which is just north of Rochester,
New York. Okay.
But the Hudson Valley, that's not to say that the Hudson Valley is not a prominent region as well. I mean, there's Hudson Valley, I would say, the second greatest as far as crop goes. The southern shores of the Great Lakes up there provide really ideal apple growing conditions, just as the sort of the rich valley floors of the Hudson Valley.
Now, do you actually own the orchards? Is that how you started?
We're it's the other way around. We're actually owned by the orchard.
You're by the orchard, okay.
Right. So Semascot Orchard is they're our partners, and they're in Northern Columbia County. They grow 137 varieties of apples.
Oh my goodness.
A lot of the complexity and cider comes from the varieties of apples you use. And so
we've interviewed, what do you call those people who breed apples?
Right.
It takes like 20 years to get your variety to market.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, there's a big group of them at the University of Minnesota.
I don't think there'd be much fun having dinner with, I can tell you.
Oops.
You'd be surprised. Those Apple guys can party. They know how.
Okay.
I mean, at least in my experience. But they, anyways, having an orchard, involved that has 137 varieties is great because we always, have these really great juice blends to as a starting point for a lot of the ciders that we make.
Now, for those people who don't know, cider apples are different than eating apples, right?
Right. Yeah. There's there's like the traditional apples used to make cider are generally very bitter, and also some of them can be super acidic. And they're not really that pleasant to eat. Some of them are actually pretty good, or at least I like them. But a lot of them, you just bite into them, and they call them spitters. You essentially take a bite, and they immediately make your mouth dry up, so you want to spit them out. Yeah.
Now, it's interesting. I was raised in England, and of course, Americans make apple pie, but the English make lots and lots of apple pie. But the preferred apple for an apple pie in England is what's called a cooking apple.
Okay.
And cooking apples are sour, just exactly like described
as
spitters.
Yeah, well, we have cooking apples.
Yeah, I guess you have, but not. I mean, a lot of people.
Sour cherries for cherry pie too.
But a lot of people who buy their apples at Whole Foods markets, for example, would be looking for a long time to find a cooking apple.
Well, now one of the things that caught our attention here was your urban orchard project, which seems to be very much on trend for what we're trying to do, integrating, all these things with cities. Talk to us about that. What is it?
Yeah, so the Ninepin Cidery is in downtown Albany, with capital New York State, and a lot of people don't realize, but New York has a couple big, significant sort of apple medals awards. It's the second largest producer of apples in the country, and it has the most diverse apple crop in the country. So there are more varieties of apples grown in New York State than anywhere else, and there's also a humongous crop here. So in the city of Albany, there's all sorts of plaques and memorials for all these significant things about the state. There's some stuff about its history, but there's really nothing that memorializes and recognizes its agricultural resource, its greatest agricultural resource, which is the apples. And, there's a reason it's called the Big Apple. So what we're doing is we're going to plant a small orchard right in the center of the city in Washington Park. It's going to start with around 10 trees, and each one of those trees is going to be of a different apple variety, which is significant to the state. And the idea is to raise awareness and education about New York's apple resource, and and with high hopes of it in the future becoming a place that can be a good source of interesting fruit for the people of the city and for visitors, and maybe we'll make a batch of cider out of it someday.
So that's a secondary thing. The cider is secondary to your orchard.
Correct. It's not. I mean, of that size, 10 trees. It's not really of real, commercial value for a cidery.
Yeah.
And it's on public space, so it's not like we can really make it economic. So it's open to the public, and it's more of an education thing in that sense. But we do have those aspirations of someday making cider with it, and, maybe helping the Washington Park Conservancy celebrate its 100th year anniversary and that kind of thing, so.
Maybe you'll grow some trees in that ugly, ugly, ugly modern area of all the state office buildings.
Yeah, the Empire State Plaza.
The Empire State Plaza. I remember walking across the Empire State Plaza one winter day and wondering if I would make it to the other side.
Yeah, it's crazy up there in the winter. It's always windy for some reason on that plaza too. There's no.
It's wide open. I bet you wouldn't get apple trees to grow very well there.
No, probably, yeah, exactly. But the place in Washington Park where we are growing them is perfect. It's on this south-facing hill slope that kind of stretches down to the lake that's in the park, Washington Park Lake. And we've Smascot Orchards, Jake Smascot, has been up there, and we've chosen the site partially for its good you know characteristics for growing trees. So, and there already is actually a large crabapple tree growing sort of in the vicinity of the site. So it's which is good for pollination and also.
No, I was going to say, what are they for? What do you do with the? I have an ornamental crabapple that does nothing.
Yeah, I mean they're great. All orchards have them, even in like commercial. Large commercial orchards have crabapple trees planted throughout because for pollination purposes.
Really?
And yep, and so having that tree there is good for that. And it's also, you know, believe it or not, crabapples when used in a blend can actually make some great fermented cider, hard cider.
Really?
Well. Oh yeah, my mother used to make crabapple jelly. So it's a big thing in England to make crabapple jelly, and. Somehow or other, if you add just the right amount of sweetness, it's just totally delicious. Put it on your toast. It's better than marmalade on your toast.
Right. Well, I mean, if you think about eating a crab apple, they have some of those exact characteristics we were talking about earlier with you know, they make you spit them out immediately. It's like they're very stringent and sour, so you can get some of those characteristics that you get in your, quote, cider apples. You can get them from just ornamental crab apples, too.
Now, we never asked you. We should have done so earlier on. Why you personally, Alejandro, got involved with cider? I mean, it's not an immediate career step that makes much sense.
Right. I mean, it comes from my personal interest in you know local food systems and growing up in Columbia County, surrounded by, in my opinion, one of the best apple crops in the entire world. And
right. Okay.
You know that. And so, you know, there's a lot of breweries and a lot of people making beer in the area that I grew up in. But, you know, you look around and I was, you know, thinking about what grows here and what kind of resources we have. And we have tons of apples. And it wasn't, at the time when we started, this was in 2013, it wasn't, you know, the cider, the interest in cider was starting to really, you know, blossom. And it just seemed like a good idea.
Well, we wish you all the best with the urban orchard project.
You sound like you're having fun too, Alejandro.
We have lots of fun. You guys should come visit.
Sure, definitely. Just the time of year that I'm rushing to get to Albany.
the plaza, once it warms up, and you know, it can be a pleasant place, and then go and you know, take a breather out by the orchard.
I think that the mobile telephone system is telling us it's time to hang up.
you've been a delight, Alejandro. Thank you for talking to us.
We'll send you a note so you don't forget to send us some samples.
Okay, yeah, send us an email and we'd be happy to eat some.
Great, thanks. Ciao.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Yeah, bye.
As they say, I guess that's a wrap.
Yes.
For one more week. We'll see you again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.